Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb@rte.ie.
Experiments, they are the lifeblood of science, and in recent months our series on experiments had looked at the unexpected, the beautiful, the wacky, even those you might be tempted to try yourself. Well, today we complete the series by looking at the long anticipated experiments, those that took ages and the ones that remain unfinished. And joining us is physicist and associate professor Shane Bergen from UCD's School of Education. Shane, lovely to have you with us again.
Good morning.
So we will start with an experiment that people might think would be easy, and that is, what is in an atom?
Classic, right? You and me and all the stars that we can see are made up of atoms. And figuring out what's in them has perplexed scientists since science started, and we're not yet finished, right? So I mentioned when I was on a couple of weeks ago about this great experiment that was done to figure out what was in them, the first one. And it was long thought that they were kind of clumpy pudding-like materials, and they fired these little pellets at them. And they discovered by firing kind of particles at atoms that atoms were predominantly made up of nothing. So they're predominantly empty space, mm-hmm. Which is incredible. And all of the matter, all the stuff of the atom is centered at the core in a place called the nucleus. And so from there, we started to develop a model of the atom. That's how science works. We develop models to explain the world around us. And this model of the atom thought that there was a little core and shells of electrons around it. And we thought, well, that's great, right? You know, maybe we've solved it. And that's what we learn in school, this so-called Bohr model of the atom. But then we looked a layer further, and we found that there were bits within the bits. We discovered what we called subatomic particles. And there's an Irish name here, the quark. Well, it's coined from James Joyce, but he would have said quark. So when I go to conferences and I hear scientists talk about it, I always correct them. Say Joyce would have said quark, because he said four quarks for Mr. Mark. So it was meant to rhyme. So I like pointing that out.
Good. That's your little
conferences.
Yeah.
My nugget, exactly.
Not annoying at all, I'm sure, for the
scientists. Physicists love it. So we have a model now in science to try and understand how all these constituent bits go. And we're still getting at it. Under the ground in Switzerland and France, there's a huge, big circular experiment called CERN. Mm. People may be familiar with it because it's been in lots of movies, like the Da Vinci Code, for example. And it's called the Large Hadron Collider. And it's a big 27-kilometre ring. It sends particles flying around at almost the speed of light into one another to create new particles, to understand the bits within the bits. And people will famously remember the Higgs boson that was discovered there not so long ago, and how that revolutionized.
The God particle, is it?
Yes, the God particle, because the Higgs boson, long predicted but took ages to find, is what's thought to give mass to objects. So some subatomic particles have mass, others don't. And the Higgs field and the Higgs boson is thought to give mass to things, which is profoundly fundamental, hence the name God particle. It allows things with matter to exist.
So work on the atom is not finished.
Oh God, no.
And work in progress.
And if we were to weigh the universe, imagine we can do that. We can tell that we can only account for a proportion of the matter that's out there. There's so-called dark matter. Mm-hmm. So there are particles out there that we haven't discovered yet. And we'll have to do lots of experiments to try and get at them. At the moment, all the ones we're doing are failing.
Well, you mentioned the dark, which brings me to the light. Understanding how light travels. Another one that I think people might think, well, we've done that, haven't we? We've worked that out.
Yeah, yes and no is always the answer in science. Is like, we have, but we've more to do, right? We're like Fianna Fáil, a lot done, more to do, right? So we if you think of light, it travels in a wave, right? So the light is shining off my face, and it's reaching your eyes, or it takes a certain amount of time to get from the sun to the earth. All of these things, it moves in waves. And we assumed, like all other waves, it had to go through a medium. So sound goes through the air, etc. And lots of experiments were done to try and figure out what was that medium, right? What was the stuff that light waves were going through? And we invented this idea called the ether, right? It still persists in regular language. And lots of experiments were done to try and discover the ether. And my God, did they get more and more precise. But the more they put into it, the more they realized it just didn't exist. There's a famous experiment done by a couple called Michelson and Morley to try and to figure out what the ether was. And it just completely failed spectacularly. Mm-hmm. But they got the Nobel Prize for it. But that failure led to Albert Einstein then reconceptualizing what the idea of light is. And he turned physics on its head at the beginning of the 20th century with his famous theory of special relativity. In it, he understood that light is actually a universal constant in the universe. In other words, the speed of light, which is, it's about 1 billion kilometers an hour, pretty fast, it is universal. So regardless of whether it's fired off from a shooting gun or fired from a stationary point, light itself is a constant. And from that kind of radically different way of thinking about it, a whole new area of physics started. And one of the consequences of his work at that time was the famous E equals MC squared experiment, which showed that energy and mass are equivalent. These sorts of things, these profound revolutions, all came from failure, and they took a long, long time for scientists to figure out.
And there's an Irish connection to E equals MC squared, right?
Absolutely. And so what it says is that you can take matter, right, mass, things, that's the M, and you can turn it into raw energy. So what the Irish connection here is a guy called Walton from Belfast. And he basically, he took lithium ions, tiny little particles, in Cambridge in the 30s, and he bombarded them with protons, tiny little particles. And he was able to blast them apart. So he split the atom for the first time. And in doing so, he created two new particles and released a massive amount of energy. And of course, to quote Yeats, a terrible beauty was born, this idea of being able to harness what they call the strong force in physics. To split an atom was to create an atom bomb, or an energy of enormous consequence that we are still grappling with, mm-hmm, since. You know, so the Irish connection there is a little dark, but transformative. And okay, it took time.
So that brings us back to what's happening in CERN with the atom, right?
Yes, because they used,
all linked,
they used this particle, this proton, in an experiment called an accelerator. So they took these little protons and they fired them at the lithium atom in a particular way in order to split it apart. It sounds simple, but it was incredibly complex to do. And the machinery of what they did has been brought on year after year since the 1930s. And we would call that now an accelerator. And those accelerators are used in places like CERN. And I know scientists, even though it costs, it's on the order of about 10 billion, but it's said to have led to the internet. So to talk about the law of unintended consequences, you had a professor on from Cork earlier talking about funding in higher education. And I think often we can think of funding for these things as very linear. We know what the problem is before we start and we set out to solve it. That happens. But also in science and in research, you get these unintended consequences.
Yes.
So 10 billion euros, mm-hmm, of investment to create CERN, which led to a fundamental understanding of the universe, but also consequences like the internet, I think is money well spent.
Yeah, and also, you know, as you've explained to us, what results from failure is often the most important discovery.
Yeah, and clever failure. So it's, you know, it's understanding not just that it went wrong, but maybe why it went wrong and what you could learn from it, how you could change it. It's this idea of scientists being stubborn, but yet not just doing the same thing over and over again, trying to iterate and trying to learn.
All right, well, tell us now about experiments to measure the age of the Earth, Shane.
Yeah, again, there are Irish links here. Imagine that for a long time, we just wouldn't have known how old the Earth was. And the best guess we had for a long time was from an Irish archbishop called Usher. He was also an academic in Trinity. And he went to the Old Testament of the Bible and he took out one of the books that had all the kind of generations listed. And he worked out basically how old the Earth would be based on the lists of names in the Bible. And he figured it out. He said that the Earth started in 4004 BC, right, which is completely wrong. But they wouldn't have known. They'd no other ways to know. And that logic sort of lasted for a long time until another Irish person called Kelvin, a famous physicist, came along in the 19th century. And he assumed that the Earth would have started as a molten ball of rock and it's been cooling steadily since, and that we could work out the rate of cooling to understand when it started. And he estimated that the Earth was 100 million years old. So a big jump from a couple of thousand years. But it was still wrong. And Kelvin was such a dominant figure in science that people didn't want to question him. And even though the geologists were able to see that things existed, the rocks were there, the formations of the Earth. In other words, what they were seeing wasn't consistent to what Kelvin was saying. And so there was a lot of arguments in science at the beginning of the end of the 19th century to figure out how old was the Earth. The physicists were wrong. The geologists were right. The Earth we know now is 4.5 billion years old. And the reason Kelvin was wrong is that he didn't know about radioactivity. And so the Earth actually has sources of heat within it. So it wasn't cooling at a steady rate. It took an awful long time and an awful lot of arguing within science for them to figure it out. Lest listeners would think, though, maybe scientists are always wrong and I shouldn't trust them. This is important. Science is self-correcting, but it can take time. But it's not that scientists are ever absolute or we're 100% certain. I wouldn't trust a scientist that said they're 100% certain. We quote our certainty. So we give error bars on what we say. Mm-hmm. So when we say we have learned that, you know, we always couch it in terms of what the uncertainty that might exist. And so when people are thinking about whether they should trust science or not, they should listen carefully to the language the scientist is using to kind of give a sense as to how certain they are of their finding.
And do you think that that situation would exist now, where you mentioned there that Kelvin was so dominant that people didn't really question what he was saying about the age of the Earth? Has that changed a lot?
Yes and no. There are an awful lot more scientists in the world than there were before when Kelvin was working. And science is hyper-competitive. There are just not enough jobs in universities for all the scientists out there to do their work. And so people have to be really competitive to get ahead. So sometimes that leads to poor practices, right? We see a lot of fraud now in scientific literature, use of AI to write papers, etc. But then you have disciplines that might have fixed mindsets about certain things. I was just talking to a philosopher of science yesterday. She's today speaking at a conference on science and democracy on this very topic. Heather Douglas is her name, how we can correct within science. And she said sometimes scientists are uncomfortable at a disciplinary level with hearing that certain things they have always perceived to be true to perhaps be uncertain. One of them, for example, is...
Well, we're all like that, aren't we?
We are. But we tell ourselves as scientists, as professionals, that we're somehow sometimes above this, that we're objective. But science, of course, is done by humans. And we are flawed as individual humans. We're susceptible. We all have, you know, professional things going on in our heads. I have to get ahead, I have to get promoted. But yet we should try and work with our peers as much as possible to be responsible, to be ethical, and to be open and transparent about what's happening. And when we make mistakes, that we are big enough, we're humble enough to see it and to recognize it and to grow from it. And unfortunately, there are still a lot of things that are perceived wisdom in science that are sort of shaky. The classic one being the theory of how Alzheimer's starts with plaque in the brain. It turns out that there isn't an awful lot of evidence for that, but that logic has persisted. And I bet you there's scientists at home that might be listening this morning saying, what's he talking about? Like he's wrong. But what I'm pointing at is just one example of an area in science where there isn't the certainty. The same with psychiatric medicine. An awful lot of the ideas around psychiatry are challenged at the moment by scientists. I'm not saying who's right, who's wrong. I'm just saying it's an area that's contentious. And when experts disagree, that's a good thing, because science is often portrayed in the media as a fait accompli. We've got all figured
absolutes,
out. Absolutes. In fact, what's going on is a very sophisticated type of arguing. Sometimes it works out really well. And then other times there can be holy war within academic disciplines about trying to figure these nuances out.
OK, a couple of messages coming in. Emmett says, Emmett was watching an episode of The New Generation last night. And he wants to know, in your opinion, how big a computer with current technology would it take to achieve the transportation in Star Trek? Now, Emmett apologises, but he does explain that he was watching an episode of The New Generation last night.
So Emmett is wondering, could we have teletransportation? The answer is yes, right? So we're able to move single particles of light called photons from one place to another. We can do it. Now, we can't beam us up like you'd see Captain Kirk, etc. doing it. But there are experiments that are happening at the moment about moving pieces of information from one point to another in a way that would be similar to what Emmett is looking at. Isn't that just remarkable that
he wants to know how big the computer would need to be with current technology?
Putting
you under pressure here now, Shane.
I'm going to say, you know, for the scientists that are working in that area, really big and really expensive, and fund them well, Emmett. That would be my recommendation.
And Bob, who was listening to our discussion around the attempts to measure the age of the Earth, would like to know, are we including the time before the last Big Bang in all of this?
Oh, well, now, there's a very good question. When did the universe begin as opposed to when did the Earth begin? So the universe began about 12 billion years ago in an event called the Big Bang, right? So we know that now with quite a degree of certainty. We don't know what happened before it, right? Or actually, that doesn't make sense. Time started at the Big Bang. So there's the concept of before doesn't make any sense. And I would say to your listener there that put down the physics book and open up the philosophy books to try and start to think, and he should think, about the concept of before in an era where there wouldn't have been time.
Mm-hmm. And a listener would like us to give the Ernest Walton atom splitter back to Dungarvan.
Ah, yes, of course he
has Waterford. What's the backstory there? It's Waterford connections.
Yes, he has Waterford connections, and he was a very famous physicist in Trinity for many years. A great story. Actually, Trinity Physics is celebrating 300 years this anniversary, and I had the great pleasure of interviewing Eric Finch, who was a professor there and wrote the book Three Centuries of Physics in Trinity College Dublin. If anyone is interested in this sort of stuff, I'd recommend they check out that book. It's a great read about the history of physics in Ireland,
including Walton. That was a good dodge there, Shane. Well done. Shane Bergen, Associate Professor from UCD School of Education. Thank you so much for coming in. We'll see you soon, no doubt. We'll take a break back after this.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.